And he's just like nestled into this wonderful arm. And I lean over to Naomi and I say, I want to get a 45 foot stuffed Falcor, stick it in a room and have two doors that would swing open should he ever come to life.
Because if a giant imaginary
stuffed Falcor ever comes to life, she wants to be able to set it free.
It's completely logical. Don't at me. Taking this very seriously.
I feel so serious right now.
Super serious.
I'm so serious. So we see the Gamork. Blah, 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 blah. Now we get to Atreyu waking up in a little cove by a little stream. And we have what I call, because of the events of the future, stupid establishing affection with the horse shot.
Because his horse nuzzles him and is like, hey, I want something to eat. You definitely don't want to read the book then. I'm just going to give you a heads up. Don't read the book. No. I'm like debating on this note that I'm okay.
No, just do it. Look, you know what? I am with you and for you. Pull whatever trigger you want and I will suffer the consequences with great joy and appreciation for the effort you're putting in.
Okay. Well, I'll bring that up. I do call Atreyu and Artax A team and they're making their I call Gamork G team. I mean, but yeah. And so there's, again, you know, sweeping landscapes. And Bastion is saying that they went through all of these wonderful places and they ended up in the swamps of sadness looking for Morla, the ancient one. I think that's what he says. In the book, it's the aged one. But I think ancient one is what he's actually saying.
Well, the horse nudges Atreyu away.
Oh, okay. I'm skipping ahead.
No, just only in my notes ahead. But only because this is our really fourth wall break. And I guess, are we the fifth wall? Freaking not. There's so many walls.
Right.
Okay. So
we are the fourth wall of the fourth wall break. And our listeners are the fourth wall of the fourth wall of the fourth wall.
I don't know much about
exponents,
but that's a lot of walls.
Fourth wall cubed?
No, it's like
squared.
It's one of those mathematical shapes that bends in on itself.
Oh no.
We're going into the fourth dimension.
Look, guys, a horse wakes a little boy up. Little boy's like, what are you up to? Oh, I bet you're hungry. And then Bastion back in the attic of his school is like, oh, right, I'm hungry.
He says, no, it's a great time to eat.
Yeah. And he grabs his food. He has like a peanut butter jelly sandwich and an apple. And that's it. He's a latchkey kid. He's making his own lunch.
Yep.
It takes him 45 minutes to put it on the bread, but he made it.
It's probably butter and jam.
And an egg and some orange juice.
And so
I was just going to say that the media finally, I'm getting back into the schizo stuff, but the media has now influenced his dietary restrictions.
Because he didn't eat until the book told him to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was inspired by the media. It told him. And he was like, oh, right, I got to eat. But he takes a bite or two of his sandwich. And then this is Bastion speaking, because we don't actually see what Atreyu and Artax eat. But Bastion takes two bites and he's like, no. He stops. He goes, no, not too much. Still a long way to go. And I had to write that down because I'm like, dude, you're like a suburban kid who chose to skip class and you got your whole lunch there. Like, my notes say, I roll laugh track.
He's obviously on a bipolar episode and he can't escape himself.
Put your own stuff on this poor kid.
This is a mirror movie.
You know what? Jonathan could be Bastion. When we got together, we started naming kids and stuff. And he's like, I want a kid named Sebastian. And I was like, no, because people call him. And he's like, when we call him Bastion. And I was like, no, people will call him Bastard. Like that Homer Simpson rant with you can't name a kid Bart because they'll name him Fart or whatever. There's a whole rant. Yeah. Look it up on your fine YouTubes.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go to Morla.
Okay, so they are coming through. Atreyu and Artax are coming through the Swamps of Sadness looking for Morla, the Ancient One.
They call it the Deadly Swamps of Sadness.
Oh. And the thing about the swamps is that if anybody lets the swamp take over them, they will sink into the swamp.
Yeah.
This happens to our beloved horse, Artex.
Okay, so here's the thing. If you lose your will to live, you sink into this black mud. What has happened to this horse? Like this super manic horse. This horse is so sad.
I think it's just the pull of the swamp itself. At least that was the way I always figured it. Again, in the book, they kind of explain it a little bit better. But the book also does something that kind of like rips your heart out a little bit.
Okay, do it. Pull my beating heart from my chest.
Artex talks in the book.
Shut! There's no comedy gold here, Lydia. I'm just sad that I didn't get to have the talking horse.
I know.
And it still goes the same way?
It pretty much goes the same way.
So he's talking the whole time? So he's like not only just a depressed horse that I know from the movie, but he's like a talking depressed horse?
Go ahead, John.
Like Mr. Ed? Like this is a Mr. Ed moment saying,
Jonathan,
I know
Jonathan,
so bad
Jonathan,
right now,
Jonathan, 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 Mr. Ed would never lose the will to live. And I am offended that you would even think so.
So you know how you said there wasn't any comedy gold?
This isn't comedy, Lydia. This is life.
Remember that movie, Hot to Trot?
Oh, God. Did you have a horse when you were younger?
I went to horse camp twice.
Oh, wow.
So I've mucked out stalls. Mm-hmm. And it was only like a 3-day camp, but I've saddled and ridden horses and stuff, mm-hmm. which makes me sound super privileged. But it was just like a 3-day camp, like twice in elementary school over 2 different summers. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'll tell you, the book, I mean, it's always like, what kind of a voice are you putting in there for it? I also got the audiobook because I absolutely love this story and I'm like falling in love with the book more and more. So it's one of those things where the guy who's reading the audiobook, he has this kind of like, the horse is pretty monotoned. So I didn't necessarily feel like he was like super depressed before going into the swamps. But what got me, now I didn't cry, but it got me, is when Atreyu's like, but I'm not sinking into the swamps. I'm not feeling all depressed. And Artax is like, it's probably because you have the Orin. And he's like, oh, well, I'll put it around your neck. And he's like, no, you weren't allowed to give it away to anyone. And like Atreyu's like trying to come to grips with the fact that his horse is dying in front of him. And Artax says, I need you to grant me one wish.
Oh, God.
And Atreyu's like, of course, I'll grant it to you.
No, don't say till you know. I mean, you should say now, but what I'm saying is that if somebody asks you a thing, you should caveat that.
Artex asks Atreyu to walk away so he doesn't see his final moments. This is like the noblest of steeds, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, so in the movie. Okay, so one point is like Atreyu's pulling on this horse's reins and this horse looks super pissed. Because I'm thinking of it, like my brain switches back and forth to like the mechanics of having to shoot the film and like the actual story. So mm-hmm. this horse is physically being lowered on an elevator that's in mud and he's not having it. Like they only get about, they don't even get all the way up to his chin. They get half to 2/3 up his neck.
Yeah.
But like he's getting tugged on and he's like, I hate this. Okay. I learned a couple things about the scene. One, there's an elevator. Two, Atreyu, Noah got his foot stuck on that elevator and he got sucked under the mud and they couldn't get him out until he had already passed out. Yeah, he almost died. He almost died twice in this film.
Oh my goodness.
Until you do the other one at the end. And so, okay, but in the film, tugging on, horse looks terrified, cuts away from the horse. Atreyu is just crying. He's sitting in the mud, not sinking. Now I know because he's wearing a fancy piece of jewelry. But then they cut back to Bastion, who is just sobbing over a book. And now it's caveat corner. What's the first time you cried at a book? It can be alone or with people.
I don't think I've ever cried while reading a book. I'm a horrible reader.
No. Here's the thing. Like, I'm not much of a crier, but there are certain things that get me. I cried at the end of Stephen King's Insomnia, but I think that was junior high. In sixth grade, I think my sixth grade teacher, Mr. WP, shout out. He read us White Fang, and I cried in class. Hard alone.
To be fair, I don't think I've ever cried at, like, I've definitely like cheered and I've definitely laughed my ass off and I've definitely been scared, but there's only been one piece of media that has ever, like, it has always made me tear up, and it's the Toast Dog's Wedding. So
Toast Dog's Wedding. Kind of memory jogging are you doing?
Okay, so there's a show called Bee and Puppycat. I absolutely love it. It's available on YouTube. I will probably be writing some blog posts about it because there's going
to
be
I've only seen the first season and you sent me a link and I'm going to go there and I'm going to enjoy it.
Yes. But there is the very last episode is called Donut. And the last four episodes, the way that Natasha Alighieri wanted to go ahead and put them all together, you would see all four in sequence. And that's Toast, Dogs, Wedding, Donut. And in Dogs, you actually see a character, Cardamom, who is like super responsible.
Oh, spoilers for something. I know we always spoil things. But, okay, so here's the thing. Hit your forward 30-second button now if you want to miss this spoiler.
How about hit it like twice?
Okay, go.
Okay, so Cardamom is, he's a super responsible kid. He is like in his house and he's getting like some food put together and he gives it, he's ultimately giving like this plate of candies to his mom who is like all like hooked up to different like monitors and a little bit of kind of bearing my soul. My mom passed away in 2010 and she was in ICU for like, it was a rough time, but you know, seeing your parent all kind of hooked up to all these different things and seeing that in media and then seeing it in the very last episode where Cardamom is like feeding her this donut that he's told is going, he just has to make a wish and he has to go ahead and like make a wish and eat this donut and your wish will come true. And he's just a little bit like, no, I don't think so. And he feeds the donut to his mom who is all hooked up. And when it doesn't work, he's like in tears. And like, even just talking about it, it makes me like tear up. Yeah, that's part of the reason why it's like I don't tear up in media, but that definitely just got to me in so many ways and it still does. So So that's probably the only time I've ever cried at anything and it wasn't a book. Sorry.
That's okay, because that is a justifiable emotional connection and that is what we're all about.
Yes.
And now that the horse is dead and everybody's crying, we can go to the sassiest Morla you ever saw.
Yeah, it's a giant turtle who has like
Atreyu mistakes her for an island and does some great pratfalls off of it. Yeah. Please pay attention to the great stunt artist who like just throws himself down that hill. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and Bastion is like, Morla, the ancient one. And he's really dramatic.
Every time he looks up and says a thing, I'm like, dude, we know. But I guess it's the only way to get him speaking lines.
Well, I mean, he could narrate anyways.
Oh, no, thanks.
Yeah. Treyu goes to speak with Morla, who turns out to be a giant turtle. And Bastion screams as soon as like in the film, we see Morla's face coming out towards the screen and Bastion screams. And this is one of those breaks where the other side gets it.
Can we talk about Morla?
Yeah. Yeah. Morla is by herself. She hasn't really been around a lot of other people.
She's been in the mud for a while. She started talking in the royal we. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's not the royal we and she's just insane and she talks to herself as we.
Yeah, because she doesn't have anybody else to talk to. Also, sometimes the best conversations are with yourself. At least that's what I always tell myself.
And you're right to tell yourself that.
Justify that insanity because nobody else is going to do it for you. Anyways.
I wrote down no man is an island, but a turtle can.
This was probably the first instance that I was just sort of like, turtles, they're always by themselves. I always want to be by myself. I should get a turtle.
I love that you have a turtle. Mm-hmm. We are. Oh, by the way, plotters, maybe you don't know this about us, but we both have bizarre exotic pets.
Exotic.
I have a parrot. He's loud and angry, not unlike myself. And then Lydia, dear Lydia, has a turtle.
Yes.
And he is quiet. And but dignified.
Yes, he likes to bask upon his toilet. I'm just saying he poos in there and he needs to poo in there. And if he doesn't, it does him wrong.
My Yoda makes poo towers. He just climbs to the same spot every day, poos, and then it just kind of stacks up.
Well, at least he's keeping it in one spot. Yeah. But Morla, you know, swimming in a swamp, so she can just like poo and move on.
I mean, it's a black, muddy swamp. Maybe the mud, it's because she's so ancient.
She's been there by herself.
Oh, maybe it's all poo. It's all Morla poo.
This is the content you come here for.
That's why it's like the despair swamp or the death swamp. It's just all sewer.
I mean, you know, but the Yelp reviews say that this place is the
Maybe this is where Eastman and Laird got their idea for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Okay, but she is the queen of the fourth wall break, second only to the... Oh, this is another female.
Yeah.
Okay, I miscounted. Sorry, two episodes ago when you were listening.
I'm pretty sure they're on the 100th episode at this point, just for the Neverending Story.
Yeah. But anyways, Morla is another girl. So we're up to three.
So Morla kind of like shows her face, and the way that it's shot in the movie, she shows her face. It's just coming right at the camera, and then Bastion screams, and then everything just kind of pauses. And in the movie, they don't give any like direct indication. Like, he didn't like read, and then they saw that someone had just suddenly screamed. It was just sort of like, he was like, that's not possible. They wouldn't have been able to hear me. And he just like moves on. And everybody else moves on too, surprisingly. I don't know. Like, if I just heard a random scream and then nothing else, I'd be a little bit like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I'd go into the other people and be like, did you hear that? Like, what the fuck was that? That would be me.
I live in Tacoma. I stop and I hear a really scary, weird noise, and I stop and I look around to see if I see anything, if I need to call somebody. And then I look at my watch to see what time it is. And then I go about my business. So that if a cop shows up, I can be like, yeah, there was a scream at like 6:45. But like, I mean, I didn't see anything, so I just went about. Mm-hmm. But now they've got an established time of crime.
Mm-hmm.
I like to keep my timelines, except for here during this podcast, succinct.
I definitely like to jump ahead, so I never look at the time.
That's all good. When Morla says, we started talking to ourselves a long time ago, I was like, girl, same.
Mm-hmm. And Atreyu's just sort of like, well, you know, you got to help me because Fantasia's dying. And if, you know, even you're not going to be able to, you know, make it. Also, I got the orange, so you got to do stuff. And Morla's just like, no, I don't really care. I don't really care at all. And so there's this back and forth between Atreyu and Morla, where Morla's constantly sneezing.
Yes. Okay. So when I first saw this rewatching, I was like, she sneezed him off the tree because he had to climb a tree to talk to her. Sneezes him off the tree. It's hilarious. Okay. So my notes are like, I wrote, because she's allergic to him. But what I heard was, I'm allergic to you. But then the second watching, it's like, I'm allergic to youth. Oh,
because she's old. She's allergic to young things.
I'm old. Go away. Get off my lawn.
Lawn. She sneezes on him like four times. I don't think we have to really reiterate each one, but everyone right. is great.
Yeah. And he eventually, she's like, nothing matters. And he's like, that's not true. If it really didn't matter, you could tell me. And this goes ahead and she's just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I didn't realize you were clever. If you had told me that at the very beginning, I'd go ahead and help you.
Okay.
Shall we do that as a trio?
Okay.
Okay.
Go to the Southern Oracle. It's 10,000 miles away. He's like, the
yeah.
So he's just kind of like trudging through. Oh, no, we don't get to that part. The next one that we have is Bastion gets distracted by the end of
the school bell rings. Mm-hmm. He runs downstairs to check everybody's leaving, and then he turns his fuzzy little butt around. Have we established that he's 10 or 11? He marches back up the stairs to the school attic and locks himself in the attic for the night.
Mm-hmm. And like, we see the lights going out, and then it like gets a little bit stormy outside, and there's like crackling of lightning and thunder, and Bastion like knocks into something, and it's like this wolf head, which transitions back into the book, and we see Gmork going after Atreyu in the Swamps of Sadness.
My notes say, great, great way to connect with your living parent, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just staying at school all night. Okay, so now Atreyu, who will never give up, because Atreyu means bold guardian, and he is out to save his land. I now, because he's walking 10,000 miles. No, 1,000? No, it's 10,000.
It's 10,000 miles but to the Southern brain, Oracle.
Okay, 10,000 miles. Yeah. I'm sorry for getting you off. You can have a whole sentence. You can have several whole sentences if you want. But I'm like, I immediately, even in my notes, I was like, I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more. And then you'd have to walk that five more times. Mm-hmm. Four more times.
20 more times.
Shoot.
500 times 2, and then multiply that by 10. So it would be like 20.
That's so many miles.
Yeah, it's a lot. And you brought up a good point in the viewing where it was like, he didn't sink when his horse died. He's just sitting in there. And maybe that's because of the power of the Orin. But in the movie, they don't reference that at all, because Artax doesn't talk, which would have killed the children in the audience.
My heart would have died.
Yeah. We see him in the scene sinking slower and slower into the swamp. And I equated it as like, he has a task to do. He is a warrior and he has a goal and he has to accomplish that. And so that's why the swamp doesn't overtake him when his horse dies. Mm. But now that he has pretty much met someone who has said, you will never get there, he's like given like, it's 10,000 miles away. He's just like, that's so far. I don't think I can do that. That's when the sadness of the swamp starts taking him.
He's crawling around in the mud. Can I just draw your attention to my physical notes where I have written luck dragon in fancy cursive and covered it in hearts and swirls? Because this is where the movie finally picks up for me. Like, now I stop hitting my head on the wall every time somebody does something that you have to like figure out.
Because Falcor's there.
Oh, Falcor, why isn't this movie all about you, Falcor?
I was 3 when this came out. I don't remember. I must have seen it on VHS first. And my little brain had put together that the horse had died and become a dragon of some kind, like a luck dragon.
I thought they were the same...
Person,
applauders. Applauders. My producer and new co-host, Jonathan, has alerted us to new headcanon that we would like to institute immediately. Artrex dies. He becomes Falcor.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You just lock that in your brain hole. That's how it is now.
He just, his friend gets returned to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's redeeming. Ugh.
I will tell you in the book.
No,
it does. It totally makes sense. Even with the book, there is an entire chapter where Atreyu meets Falcor. Because in the book, Atreyu doesn't sink into the swamp because he's protected by the Orin. So he's not going to sink in the swamp and Falcor is not going to come out of nowhere. Falcor is actually entangled in a web with this many bodied.
Oh, it's the
beast.
I read something about it. I read a blurb about it. It's wasps in the form of a giant spider.
Yeah, but it can also take other forms. And it's called Yurgrimal, the many.
Yeah.
But Falcor is entangled in it. So if you wanted to go with that canon,
yeah, I'm with it.
I think he came back out of the swamps as the luck dragon, and now he's named Falcor. And he got entangled into the web.
Into it.
Yeah.
Okay. But we find our friend Atreyu wakes up in the arm of Falcor. And connection, because why not? Nurtured by the luck dragon, a kind of megafauna? Not unlike a certain Mr. Tusk.
And he's just like nestled into this wonderful arm. And I lean over to Naomi and I say, I want to get a 45-foot stuffed Falcor, stick it in a room, mm-hmm. and have 2 doors that would swing open should he ever come to life.
Because if her giant imaginary
stuffed Falcor ever comes to life, she wants to be able to set it free.
It's completely logical. Don't at me.
Dude, when I hug my teddy bear, he's got to be face up, pointed out, because I don't want to suffocate him. And I'm real grown, and that's a real fake animal, so I can't really fault you on your fantasies.
I really just think I want something big that I can just, like, maybe I just need an oversized beanbag chair. Yeah. With a face. A luck dragon face.
Image-wise, that's really disturbing. Let's move on. Only because this...
Yeah.
Atreyu starts to try to tell his story to Falcor, and Falcor's like, I already know.
Mm-hmm. You talk in your sleep.
Yeah. What kind of... And this is for you, Drake. Expositional talking is this kid doing in his sleep?
I am Atreyu. I will seek the oracle. I wish this is a really nice fuzzy pillow. I found some. It's nice and warm. I think some elven people are giving me medicine in it. Anyway, stabbing with needles and stuff.
Almost died.
My horse dies.
And he just sits up in a nightmare. He's like, and it goes right back to sleep.
Southern Oracle, 10,000 miles.
How far did you fly me?
Yeah, 9,891 miles.
So I had my nephew in my ear when I originally wrote this down, and I wrote 8,991 miles, which makes a lot more sense for how much walking he has to do. But it's actually for your notes at home, applauders, it's 9,891 miles.
Mm-hmm. And Falcor is just like, yeah, it's just like right across the corner. Look. And Atreyu goes up and he sees like this like old short couple.
Oh yeah, I call them little nerd couple.
Yeah, they're gnomes pretty much.
Shout out, this little nerd couple reminds me a lot of a certain little nerd couple in Princess Bride.
Mm-hmm. Which one came out first?
I think this one came out first.
But like the books, I mean, because if they came out around the same time, I'm not going to say that anybody like stole from the other, but it still is like kind of, it's still like kind of an 80s trope. The old bickering couple.
I mean, that's just a lifelong trope. That's a couples having existed long trope, but they are very similar. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Princess Bride was written in 1973.
Oh.
Or published.
So it came out a decade before this.
Yeah.
That's substantial. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say nothing because I don't know when was it translated to German?
Doesn't say.
It has always been available in German.
It's a lie, and you know it, McQuaid. But whatever.
Forever, it has been German. Never ending.
Good biscuits. Okay, look.
Falcor winks a lot, which I think we need to note.
Mm-hmm. Just because it creeps me out a little bit. Just because it's like one giant eye closing and opening. But then the little couple starts talking to Atreyu, and they are just, you know, they're bickering, and they're, you need to talk about the Oracle. He needs medicine, and I'm right, and you... Back and forth.
And of course, the wife, whose name is Urgle, she kind of like says, nope. He's still my patient. You don't get him until I say so. And she asks Atreyu, how does it feel? And he's like, oh, you know, it's still a little painful, but it's all right. And she's just sort of like, it has to hurt if it's to heal.
Which then my notes say, yeah, but like,
what?
No, it's heavy-handed platitudes for children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's themes of coping with mourning throughout this entire film, which is compelling and something I truly enjoy about the film, except for when they shove it up your nose like this, where right. It's like, it has to hurt if it's going to heal. Well, that's probably true, but there's probably a better way to communicate that than like a crotchety old... But you know what? If I didn't feel that way, like if it was like tomorrow or the next day, I'll probably be like, the crotchety one with the platitudes is my favorite because she just tells it like it is. But today, for what it's worth, my feeling is like, oh, maybe.
Right. I mean, the whole idea that it has to hurt... I mean, that right there, like, oh, so in order for me to get something good, I always have to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I'm going through something, I think the whole idea is like, oh, if I'm going through something terrible, then I have to just sort of let that hurt in order for myself to like heal. And I'm sort of like, maybe in certain circumstances, but that's not pretty universal. And the way that they put it out there is like, this is universal. And they don't really change that from the book.
Yeah, well, there's certainly times in real life where you have to sit with pain and make room for the grief you'll just end up living with when you mm-hmm. lose something. Somebody that you love. So I get what I think they're trying to do, I think, but I still have feels that maybe I'll work out when we get to part number 50.
Yeah.
In this recording.
And so she gives them some warm tea.
And then she lists off the ingredients and it's well gross. She's like, oh, there's like a feather in there, and there's like an egg and a
mm-hmm. It's actually called the bat wing broth. It's her bat wing broth. And then she lists out all the ingredients in there.
Did you just remember that off the top of your head?
But somehow you remember batwing soup. What I'm asking is, how did you remember batwing broth?
I've seen this movie. I had the same problem with VHS tapes that everybody, every other millennial kid in the 80s probably had.
Watching and watching. Head cleaner.
Yeah.
Okay. So nerd guy whose name is...
Ingiwook.
He's like, I'm a scientist, and I have you don't if you heard of me, no, you don't travel in scientific circles.
Yeah, he's a little put out.
But he wants to share about the Oracle because he's been studying. He's like, I'm writing a book, The Oracle for 100 years, the beginning.
Oh my God. Now, later on, Atreyu asks Ingiwook, so have you ever actually been there? And he's just like, well, what do you think? I work scientifically. That doesn't answer his question.
I think it means no.
That's exactly what
it
means.
I'm going to observe it from far away,
and I can confirm that because I read that part in the book. It's just kind of this little telling moment where he's like takes like experiences that other people have, and he doesn't actually know what the Southern Oracle is because nobody tells him. And and like towards the end, he kind of like regrets never going. So it's like he kind of regrets not ever trying it out for himself.
Because it expires once it's gone through or something?
Well,
it's a one and done-er.
In the book, there's a specific reason why the Southern Oracle is like vanishing, and it's because of the nothing. And so it was just the fact that he had spent his entire life's work on trying to find this one thing. And instead of like picking up and going, it's one of those things where he could have done that sooner, and he waited too long, and now it's no longer there.
Well, anyways. Right now we're in this. The joy of watching somebody nerd out is one of my favorite things in the whole world. So when he's just like, come on, Atreyu, we're going to go and look at this knight approaching the oracle. He wants to show it to him. And he says to his wife, I'll let you have it. Go for it.
You want me to say it?
Say it.
It's your favorite line.
Oh, but that's because I want to hear other people say it.
To the winch, wench.
And so the wife is like cranking him up this thing.
like this is how you know they have a really solid relationship. They bicker and bicker, and yet she will still trudge him up so he can go ahead and nerd out.
Yeah. Atreyu has to climb, though. He has to climb this whole hill.
Atreyu is a lot taller than Ingiwook, though.
Yeah. I would say that they're probably six to 12 inches tall. They're not very big at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so they get to the top, and here we see what I have dubbed gleefully watching a knight go towards his certain death.
The first gate, there are two gates to get to the Southern Oracle in this movie, and the first gate checks your confidence level, and I'm like, I'm never going to get past this one. The second gate I could totally get through, but the first gate I have no confidence, and we kind of start seeing that this knight, he apparently isn't confident either, even though he's got like this super fancy horse decked out in knight attire, because when he gets to the oracle, their eyes open and they laser blast them.
Okay, so I wrote in my notes, this is where I die. But after having conversed with you a little bit, I feel like whereas you would have died at the first and made it through the second, I would have gone through the first and died at the second.
Can I just say I would have died just staring at boobies? I wouldn't have been able to get through. Oh, yes.
The breasts, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get to the meat of the matter.
So this gate is to...
Oh, hold on a second. Okay. I want you to go there. But what I want to say is Knight gets turned into Crispy.
Ingiwook
is like... He's like totally into it. He loves it so much.
Scaredy cat, go on.
What a jerk. You're not doing it. Like, if you, okay. But anyways, Atreyu's like, okay, I'm going to go do it now. And he's like, what? I haven't told you about the second oracle yet. And like, Atreyu's gone. And Falcor stays up on the hill getting medicine from the chick whose name is
Urgle.
And so now I feel like it's a more distinct time to as we approach the first gate.
Right. So Atreyu goes walking to the very first gate, and there's sphinxes, and they're looking at each other. It's very Egyptian.
Yeah, they're faced towards each other. They can't look at each other, though.
Right, because their eyes are closed.
Thank you.
And they have the face and upper torso of a woman. Their legs are, I want to say they're cat-like. Like,
the sphinx's cat body.
Yeah, but their hind legs looked almost bird-like.
Oh.
So, I mean, from what I was seeing, they almost looked a little like...
They've got wings.
Yeah, so maybe that's where it is. It's like part cat, part bird, part lady.
That's close enough for me, because all you really look at it, other than their size and their giant and their gold...
Boobs with erect nipples.
I mean, it's not overstated, but for like, consider how many boobs you saw as a kid. If you were a closely held like child of the 80s, like, you weren't seeing much past PG most of the time.
It's kind of funny that this gets a free pass. Maybe it's because it was European.
And it was fairly subtle. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my nephew didn't seem to care much about it at all.
Right. I remember seeing that as a kid and being like, pretty sure I'm not supposed to see this, but whatever.
I was very much like, look everywhere but there. Look everywhere but there. But I was so terrified of this scene as a kid that I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Atreyu is approaching, and Ingiwook is looking through the telescope, and Bastion is telling him to be confident, and Ingiwook is saying, be confident, and Atreyu gets closer and closer, and he sees the eyes of the Sphinx opening up.
Bastion's like, be confident! Be confident!
Yeah.
Be confident!
And then when they see the eyes opening up, Bastion starts telling Atreyu to run, and then Atreyu just books it, which when we were watching this, I was like, is that how you wield confidence? You just sort of approach slowly and then just run through?
Yep.
Do the thing, book! Do the thing in the book! Book, do it!
I approach a lot of situations like this, just being like, I know what's going on, and then just pulling my hand back before the trap snaps. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's one thing to be confident walking through the forest. It is a different thing to be confident when stepping into a bear trap.
So he gets right through that gate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it blasts behind him. It's like their eye beams shot together, and he's just out of the way in the nick of time.
Right. And so Ingiwook says, but I didn't tell him about the second gate. And it's called the Magic Mirror Gate, and it shows you who you really are.
Wait.
who you are. Moana. Okay. And this was always something that stuck out to me. This is why I think I could go ahead and pass through it, because I'm pretty self-aware. Like, I think of the worst thing anybody ever showed myself was just like the worst person in the entire world. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much how I see myself every day. But if someone showed me like the best person in the world, I'd probably be like, yeah, but I see myself. That's exactly how I see myself every day.
You are every man. Is that what you're telling me? Like,
I was thinking I'm like constantly like there's like a war that's constantly raging inside of me between like ultimate good and ultimate evil.
But that would lead you to be able to walk through that gate.
Yeah, because I'm aware of that.
I have that, but it is slightly off from that. So here's the thing. I'd walk through the first gate and I'd be like, somebody's got to walk through this. And I've been told I'm supposed to do it. So crispy critter or not, I'm walking through this thing, and I would just walk through it. Mm-hmm. Right. But if I got to that mirror, whatever they showed me, my like cognitive dissidence would be like, no, you're not that. In the same way that you're like, oh yeah, no, I'm Hitler. Oh no, I'm Mother Teresa. I'd be like, I would not compare myself to Mother Teresa. I mean, if I'm Hitler, then I must be worse than Hitler. If it's showing me Hitler, like, just like a little tick to the left or to the right, or right, whatever they show me is I'm going to be staring at that mirror like some vain 1980s stereotype valley girl for a long time.
Like the Californians at the end of the California scenes.
On SNL. Yes.
Oh, that's great.
That's a good reference, honey. That's exactly what it'd be like, except it would be me crying while it happened.
Yeah.
Atreyu, what are you doing here? I took the Luck Dragon up 10,000 miles, spoke to some small people on the 305.
Lauren Michaels, please don't sue us. We're just a small podcast in Tacoma.
We don't have any money. I mean, if you wanted to try and sue us, you could, but you're not going to get anything.
Sorry, man. There was a cool trick here. The mirror is a large circle with icicles hanging down, and you see the reflection of Atreyu. Oh, we should explain what happens. Okay, here's something I didn't know as a kid. Okay, so as a kid, I thought, oh, he's looking into the mirror and seeing his true self, and Sebastian is looking into his mirror, air quotes here, the book, and seeing his true self, give or take on that comprehension level. But I never thought they're the same person, or this is one entity acting through another. I didn't think that at all. And so like, did I miss like major symbolism in this film? And that's when my brain started, like my notes get super frantic, and I started like coming up with all these plans for what everything means, which is never a good place to spiral in a children's film about existential death crisis.
This is what Mr. Coriander is referencing in the books. He's saying, if you are, do you get into these books? Are you Captain Nemo when you read Captain Nemo? And this is where Bastian really has to confront the fact that he's kind of a character.
He doesn't confront it, though. As my whatever age self, was just like, oh, okay. And Atreyu steps through the mirror. And what I was trying to describe was there's this icicle hanging down, concealing this really cool gap that he steps through. So it's not, it's a trick of the eye. It's not any kind of CGI or trickery.
What I always thought was interesting about this is Atreyu is kind of Bastian's self-insert character. Like, if he were writing in the book that was written, the actual book that's in our world that was written, there are moments where Bastian's memories and his experiences feed into the way that the book comes into fruition. Right before they find out that the childlike empress is sick, he recalls when his mother was ill and how they were in the hospital together, or how he was in the hospital with his dad and the doctors didn't know what was going on, which, I mean, in the book, the doctors that come to see the childlike empress, they don't know what's making her sick. One person hypothesizes that it might be the nothing, but it's not substantiated. It's not like said, oh yeah, this is the connection. Yeah. But there's other areas in the book that are very much like Bastian's experiences are creating this book and creating the things that come in. So he is in essence creating Atreyu, and Atreyu is everything he wants to be. He's not brave.
Atreyu is everything I want to be.
Okay, so we've established that Atreyu is Bastian and Naomi's self-insert character.
Jonathan is Bastian and I'm Atreyu. And this is a very weird conversation.
Does that mean that I'm the childlike empress?
Oh, I hope so.
I was kind of hoping I'd be Falcor.
Be about it.
Yeah.
But you have to be Atrex first.
Artex
first.
All right. If I ever die, you have to walk away before.
Oh my gosh.
I'll be like bleeding up side of the road. I'd be like, there's no hope for me. You have to just walk away. And it'd be like, I can make a phone call to 911.
Lydia, I'd never see you. I'd never leave your side. And then you'd be like, Naomi, you must. I don't want your last memory to be me dying. And I'd be like, okay.
Choked on coffee because of that.
Just look at the flowers, Artex. Just look at the flowers.
Glasses are fogged up now. God, I got like three more pages of notes.
You know, I was so worried about how this podcast started, and now I'm not worried anymore.
Because the exhaustion of hour 7 of recording is setting in, and okay, bringing it back. Sebastian, I don't even know, because the context is still messed up for me.
Right.
But Sebastian realizes that he's looking into the eyes of Atreyu, right, or whatever. I don't remember that part as a kid, but I do remember him chucking the book across the room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what's cool is Atreyu sees that he's just, you know, this kid who's safe reading a book. And he just is like, okay. And he walks through that gate like, yeah, it ain't nothing.
It didn't seem like he was fazed by that at all.
No.
He's like, I guess I'm every woman. It's all in me.
Naturally. Right. But Bastian picks up the book again and continues, because despite how many instances he sees where, like, maybe this is telling of a mental illness that he needs help with, he still goes through the book.
Wow. Where Artax may have said nay, you've continued to say yay, applauder. Thank you for joining us in part 2. As we sink further down into the German minds behind Wolfgang Petersen's The Neverending Story. Hey, this is your audio engineer and uncredited sock puppet number 3 from the deleted scenes, Jonathan, reminding you that where there's a part 2, we're probably only about halfway done with our review. Seriously, the movie was about as long as just these 2 parts. What were we thinking? Well, we were probably thinking that our in-depth analysis of cinema's best staying power has its own never-ending appeal with you, dear applauder. So how do we remain ad-free? Ever so infrequently, one of dozens decides to pitch in for everyone else. You can do that too for $1 or $5 a month by searching for Shocked and Applaud on Patreon. We also get micro-squeeze when you share and like us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to our posts on shockedandapplaud.com. Inspired to join us for the final flyby of this fantastic children's film from 84? If you can help by sharing our episode with others, we might just start our new year together with even louder, obnoxious wit and laughter. We'll see you in 1 week for the conclusion of our review, and in 2 weeks for our end-of-the-month special episode. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.